Read and hear more about important news and policy issues at ncpolicywatch.com. This is News and Views.
Welcome to News and Views. I'm your host, Rob Schofield. State Senator Wiley Nickel of Wake County is one of the North Carolina General Assembly's up-and-coming freshman lawmakers. Despite being new to the political battles at the legislative building, however, Nickel is no political novice. The veteran attorney and former prosecutor once worked for the White House under President Barack Obama and also traveled with Vice President Al Gore during the Clinton presidency. Senator Nickel joined me in studio earlier this week to discuss a number of issues, including the ongoing negotiations over the state budget, the recent success of House Democrats in sustaining a gubernatorial veto, climate change and the need for green energy policies, and North Carolina's increasingly regressive and inadequate tax structure. Well, Senator Wiley Nickel, welcome to News and Views. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
So you're in your first term in the North Carolina Senate, and you're still standing after a good part of the 2019 session. What are your initial impressions of this? And tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and how you got into this new job.
Well, I love being there. I'm grateful for the chance to serve, and it's been a great first few months on the job. I was a political staffer for most of my life, worked for the Obama White House, worked for Al Gore when he was vice president, and just got pretty upset after the 2016 elections and put my name on a ballot, grabbed a clipboard, and that's how I got here.
Let's talk about some of the big issues that are sort of dominating debate in Raleigh right now. Obviously, the state budget, as we record this, is being negotiated between Republican conferees in the House and Senate, and then it's going to go to Governor Cooper. What's your take on this budget that the legislature has passed and that we're now probably going to be fussing over for a good while yet?
I think my first just takeaway for where we are now in June is that nothing really bad has happened. And I think that's a good message with Democrats breaking the Republican supermajority is the really bad stuff just it hasn't become law, it hasn't happened, and we haven't seen it yet. Now, the budget certainly has a lot of stuff that I consider really bad, but the main points about the budget are, you know, as you said, this is a budget that Republicans in the House and Senate sat in a private room and came up with on their own. Democrats didn't have a seat at the table. Governor Cooper didn't have a seat at the table. And Governor Cooper has talked about this over and over. He said, hey, guys, you know, why don't we all just sit down? And that just hasn't happened yet. So I think what will happen is this Republican budget proposal will very likely be vetoed by Governor Cooper after it, you know, gets the differences get sorted out between the House and Senate. And he'll veto it and hopefully we'll sustain it. And then everybody will come and sit down at the table and we'll have a budget that reflects all of North Carolina.
You would think that, you know, maybe that was the lesson that came out of the sustaining of the governor's veto of the abortion legislation, the fact that Democrats sort of held together, sustained his veto, sent a message to Republicans, okay, the supermajorities don't exist anymore. You're going to have to negotiate these things. You might as well sit down with us. Do you think that message is getting through at all, or it's going to take a few more whacks at it?
I think they'll need to get a budget veto before they change their tune. You know, but then that was a great veto. The House sustained his veto. And just to get back to my point about bad stuff not happening, you know, in Alabama, all over the South, all over the U.S., we've seen horrible anti-abortion bills. And we were able to say not in North Carolina. And so that's
the change. And a positive step. One area in which, of course, that's critically important in the budget, it's always the biggest thing that we spend money on in North Carolina is education funding. The North Carolina Association of Educators has got a truth tour that they're going on right now that they're sponsoring that they claim is about identifying some of the distortions and misrepresentations about school funding in North Carolina. There have been some progress on teacher pay, but it seems that in many other areas, we remain really far behind in catching up in education funding.
And I think that when you talk about education funding, you got to look at the whole picture. And the whole picture is per student spending. And we are 42nd in the country in spending per student. And then you get into the conversation about having teacher assistants. You know, we've gutted that position. We've lost close to 10,000.
Legislation on that, right?
To restore close to 10,000 TA positions. You know, that's important for student success. There's so much more we can be doing to invest in public education. And I think it just comes down to our priorities and our values as a state. We can continue to be the least expensive state in the South for out-of-state corporations and the ultra-wealthy taxpayers, you know, or we can roll back those tax cuts and invest in our students. And the Republicans, they're doubling down on tax cuts for corporations and the wealthy. They have close to $200 million in this budget of further tax cuts when we can't even invest in all the helping professionals we need. You know, when you talk about counselors, nurses, psychologists, social workers, those are the things that come into play for our students when you talk about per-student spending.
One of the proposals that's been advanced on the Republican side, it's sort of this, another one of these cut rate proposals is this idea of virtual schools, you know, and virtual, even pre-K is a proposal we've seen. And I understand, I guess there are kids maybe in far-flung areas for whom getting on a computer could be helpful, but I think a lot of people are troubled about the idea that we might be moving to a system in which we're going to be putting three-year-olds in front of computers for extended periods.
I can't say that's the worst education proposal that I've heard this session, because there was a proposal to arm teachers with guns.
Oh, well,
you know, so not the worst, but but really up there. I don't think our pre-K and kindergartners need more screen time.
You've also been the sponsor of some legislation this session that, I have to say, you're bringing some new ideas that just haven't even been the subject of debate in Raleigh for a while and clearly need to be. It's sort of shocking that we haven't been talking about climate change, but really ever since the Republicans took over the General Assembly, that's an issue that's sort of been verboten. Now you've sponsored legislation this session. Governor had issued an executive order which requires 40% reduction in greenhouse gases. And you were pushing something that maybe even is more ambitious than that.
We have a proposal to get 100% renewables by 2050 for North Carolina. That's, you know, what I'm really most passionate about. I worked for Al Gore. I was just somebody sitting at a climate science training with him a little over 2 years ago. And that was really kind of my big decision point, is we have to do everything we possibly can to fight the climate crisis. And on that issue, you know, if you define success for this legislature, one of the bills that I've been trying to talk a lot about is a bill that the Republicans have filed to make North Carolina the most expensive state in the country for electric vehicles. And we're making progress in getting our message out on that. The House Republicans, I understand, don't really support it. And we're hoping that at least the House Republicans will stand up to the Senate Republicans
and get rid of that. This is the goal, to increase the tax on electric vehicles.
Yeah, so currently electric vehicles pay an additional $130 a year in extra registration fees because they don't pay tax at the pump.
Right.
And this would make us go from $130 to $230. And plug-in hybrids would have to pay $115 now under this proposal. We need about $1 billion a year in infrastructure and transportation funding. This bill would give $800,000.
Right.
So
it's just a penalty on buying an electric vehicle, basically.
That's it. And the data is clear that when you tax electric vehicles like this, you have a much lower adoption rate. And I'm trying to do everything I possibly can to get more electric vehicles on the road because it shows progress in fighting the climate crisis. I drive one.
So do I.
And every day, you know, when we drive our cars, we're cleaning the air just a tiny little bit with our air conditioning.
Well, and the truth, of course, is that a lot of electric vehicles don't actually travel as many miles. There's a limitation on how far they can go. And so as a practical matter, a lot of them at this point anyway probably aren't even driving as many miles as a typical gasoline-powered vehicle, which speaks maybe that they're not using the road as much as some might say they are.
And just to dig into the weeds, too, the experts say that in electric vehicles, you know, equivalent gas taxes, only 100 a year. So, you know, 130, we're already paying more than our fair share as electric vehicle drivers. You know, so 230 really just doesn't make much sense.
Another issue you've raised that I think is getting more and more national debate, I heard a debate on it on National Public Radio the other day, is this idea of the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, the idea that we've got to get beyond the Electoral College and the idea that that's how we elect the president, that it's this sort of crazy system in which the person who loses the national popular vote, it's happened twice now in this century that they've actually won the presidency. Talk to us about that. I know it's an issue that seems to go across partisan lines both ways.
It's one of the big issues. I filed this bill to make North Carolina join the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. Close to 200 electoral votes have already signed on to this. So when you get to 270 electoral votes worth of states that sign on, we'll elect our president by popular vote. And it just gets back to the big issue with people just don't vote. They are cynical to the process. And when you have things like gerrymandering, an antiquated electoral college system, you know, they just say, why, my vote doesn't matter. For me, this was just about saying your vote, every single vote should matter, no matter where you live. And, you know, again, you know, Hillary Clinton got 3 million more votes than Donald Trump. Try explaining that to your 6-year-old.
Right. And the idea with this is simply that a state would award its electoral votes to the candidate who got the most votes in the national popular vote, because each state has the right to award its own electoral votes how it chooses, right?
That's right. So no matter how North Carolina voted, we would give our electoral votes to whoever won the national popular vote.
Right. And many states seem to be headed down that direction.
And too, just, you know, because you get a lot of people saying this is a partisan thing. John Kerry was 60,000 votes away from losing the national popular vote, but winning the Electoral College. So it can go both ways.
Yeah. As you're mentioning the issue of gerrymandering and voting, obviously this remains a huge issue in North Carolina. Gerrymandering and the fact that we have these districts, we've now have court proceedings going on that are reflecting even more damning evidence on how gerrymandering has taken place in North Carolina and what the real motives were behind it. You holding out any hope that that's something could happen in 2019, or is that probably going to wait another year for there to be real redistricting reform in our state?
I mean, I'm eternally optimistic, so I'm always hopeful that we can get beyond gerrymandering as a state. You know, we've got two court cases, one in the U.S. Supreme Court, one in the that will likely make its way to Anita Earls in the North Carolina Supreme Court. And I'm hopeful that we'll make some progress there. But there's good models, and there are Republicans, at least in the House, who support some solutions to the way we draw maps. And I try to put this stuff through the lens of talking to my 6-year-old son, and it's just cheating. You know, it's just cheating. And so there are good ways to end it. We had a group from California come out where we had a Republican, Democrat, and unaffiliated commissioner, and they have a great system where the politicians aren't in the process and they draw real fair maps.
Seems like something that ought to be a no-brainer. We wish you all the best with that and so many of these other fine initiatives you're advancing. You've got a lot of great ideas for our state, and I look forward to doing this again in the near future.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up next, the view from the other side of the state legislative building with Senator Nichols' House colleague, Representative Billy Richardson. Stay with us.